Hi there, I'm Andy Bush. Thank you for joining us. Welcome along for another edition of Scarred for Life, a deep dive into the dark dystopian pop culture of the 1970s, 80s and beyond. A nervous look over the shoulder at the things that scared us as kids and what they tell us all about the people we are today. I am joined as ever by the brilliant Steve Brotherstone and David Lawrence, co-authors of the terrifying Scarred for Life books upon which this podcast series is based. Go check them out. Every week we'll be speaking to a special guest who'll be bringing with them three horrific childhood memories that's literally scarred them for life. This week we are joined by the legend that is Charlie Higson, described by Time Out as the missing link between Dick Emery and Bret Easton Ellis. Charlie is an award-winning actor, author, comedian and musician, lead singer of the funk pop band The Higsons from 1980 to 1986. Charlie's television work includes appearances on various Reeves and Mortimer series, writing and performing on Harry Enfield's television programme and the Fast Show and its spin-off Swiss Tony. He was a writer, producer and director and guest star of BBC's Randall and Hopkirk reboot and has appeared in crime dramas Broadchurch and Grantchester. As a writer, Charlie has written five young James Bond novels, and his first adult book, On His Majesty's Secret Service, was released in May of this year. His young adult zombie apocalypse series, which began with The Enemy, was a huge hit with readers, and in 2018 he achieved a childhood dream with the publication of his fighting fantasy game book The Gates of Death. Welcome to Scarred for Life, Charlie Higson.
Well, it's marvellous to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's brilliant to have you on. Right at the very beginning of my career, when I wanted to try and get into comedy writing, I wrote you a letter. Murder, She Wrote, Jessica Fletcher. No, but I just asked, you know, for some advice, you know, how to start, etc. And you were like the only person out of everyone I wrote to who actually wrote back to me.
Oh, I actually replied.
Replied. And you said, it's sadly, it's not what you know, it's who you know.
It's true. Both.
It's a little bit of both. It's true, but thank you very much for getting back to me. I really appreciate that. You're the only person who wrote back. In fact, we had the brilliant Jamie Anderson, son of Jerry Anderson, on the podcast a little while back, and he was kind of saying to us that his industry can be a bit of a bed of vipers. What would you say about the industry that you've existed in over these years? Do you like the industry? Is it supportive?
Well, I was lucky enough, and I don't want to come across like a grumpy, sad old man, but I was lucky enough to be doing TV at a time when the BBC still had a bit of money and, you know, the 90s, and I hate to say it was something of a golden age for comedy on the TV because the BBC had this amazing lineup of executives who really loved light entertainment and comedy. There's a guy called David Liddiman who came from Granada, who was just like king of light entertainment. There was Paul Jackson, who had produced so many great comedy shows. John Plowman, likewise. Jeffrey Perkins. I mean, they're names that you'll see on a lot of credits from that time. And between them, they just, you know, put out a lot of great comedy and entertainment through the 90s, which meant that Channel 4 was competing. So they were doing a lot of stuff. ITV occasionally tried, but stuck with popular drama instead. And so it was a great time. And the BBC still did have enough money to properly pay for things. I mean, this was always an argument, a struggle over it. But and so that, you know, that was fabulous. And in the last few years, I've kind of moved away from doing comedy stuff. I don't particularly know anyone at the BBC anymore. They still make great stuff. But it's a struggle for them. It's a struggle for them to get anything properly made. And they're competing with the likes of Netflix, who have huge budgets. Although I think we will be seeing some of the streamers going under soon. It all seems to be about to implode. I had a great time and I made a lot of great friends in that world. And generally, it was a good time. Paul Whitehouse and me, we were really lucky because the BBC let us produce what we made. So we were our own producers, which was a fantastic luxury. But as I say, our executives were good. And if you've got good executives, it's a very pleasant experience.
Now, you always stood out for us when I was younger in your bit parts that you used to do on Reeves and Mortimer, Smell of Reeves and Mortimer and Big Night Out, etc. Because
funny as them.
No, you have an incredible sense of the unusual. The characters that you play, like, let's just take Swiss Tony as an example. But even the before that, the stuff you did with Reeves and Mortimer, there was one thing I think that made Reeves and Mortimer so good and those shows so good is that some of it was quite unsettling. So, I mean, this podcast is Scarred for Life. I feel like you have a kind of an affinity with stuff that's kind of slightly left of centre, slightly unusual. Would you agree with that?
Definitely. And, you know, I think one of the best remembered things that I did with Reason Mortimer was the MasterChef sketch. which was genuinely unsettling.
Terrifying.
This weird bulbous-headed Lloyd Grossman floating across the stage to the sound of mournful church bells.
Brilliant. And he had a knife and fork on his fingers, I remember,
yes,
as well.
And, you know, I hope that a lot of small children watching that were scarred for life. And because it is a sort of thing that sticks in your mind. It was after you think, did I really see that?
I can guarantee that they were, because I tweeted that and mentioned it a few times over the years. And younger viewers will say, I can't watch it. I was as traumatised by that as my generation was by, like, the Spirit of Dark and Lonely Water. It was the cake with the kind of, was it like a cake that had blood coming out of
shoe,
it and
shoe,
stuff?
Is that shoe cake as well?
It was a shoe cake, yes. Cake. And then there was Morwenna Banks. I think she'd cut off her ears, hadn't she?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Put them on a plate. But kids were mortified by that.
Well, it was, and it was genuinely atmospheric, and it worked. You know, sometimes people try and, oh, we're going to do something a bit weird or something a bit spooky, and it's all a little bit forced. But, you know, these things just came straight out of Jim and Bob's heads. And Jim particularly had this real feel for the uncanny and the macabre mixed in with humour. And that mix is always a real winner.
So do you think, like, the Fast Show could be made now? I mean, I remember speaking to Stephen Merchant about The Office when he came on our show on Absolute Radio a little while back, and he doesn't think that The Office would be made now. Do you think The Fast Show would be made now? It's a tough question.
It's an impossible question, because all comedy is of its time, and, you know, we were all the right age to make that, and therefore we were responding to all the comedy we'd watched over the years, what made us laugh, what we wanted to do. And that changes. So, you know, in a way, it wouldn't be made now, because people today would have different frames of reference and coming from a different place. But the fact of the matter is, you know, it is played regularly on UK TV. They repeated the first series. They've just finished repeating the first series. And it's just gone on to iPlayer, and we didn't have to take anything out or make any changes. So this idea of, like, oh, they wouldn't make that anymore. No, it's I hate to say this, because I do like Stephen Merchant, but it's bollocks.
That's fair. I'll pass it on to Dave.
I think the thing about the Fast Show is it's timeless. I mean, you look at Little Britain, you could not do that now. You could not do Little Britain right now.
Little Britain was deliberately pushing the boundaries. It was deliberately trying to see how far they could go. And I remember watching it, and there were other shows like it, and I remember watching it and thinking, oh, so you're allowed to do this now, are you? Because, you know, obviously I'd been through the first woke Holocaust, or whatever you want to call it, on GB News of the 80s with political correctness, which is exactly the same thing and exactly the same arguments going on. And, you know, there was a reset, and comedy got better and more interesting, and things grew out of that. And then there were... It goes in cycles, and I think we hit the noughties, or whatever you want to call it, and people were pushing against that orthodoxy and seeing how far they could go. And on the Fast Show, we never set out to be controversial and kind of in your face.
Do you think comedians should push against things all the time? Do you think that makes the best comedy?
There are so many different types of comedy, and there is always going to be a strain of comedy that does that. Even back in the 80s, you know, political correctness had been around for about 2 weeks, and people were already doing things that were pushing against political correctness. It will happen, and comedians, you know, many of them will push against the orthodoxy. It depends what you want to do. But, I mean, you know, Paul and I had grown up watching that sort of communal TV, which was quite warm. You could watch with the family. And, you know, we wanted to draw people in and make them laugh and make them happy. At the same time, you know, once you've done that, you can then do something a bit naughty.
A little bit naughty. I mean, forgive me if you have been on and done it, but has Paul tried to get you fishing? Have you ever got involved in the fishing side of things, Charlie, at all?
Well, you see, the thing about fishing, Oh, I'm sorry, I've just come. See, that was an example of some of the things where we're occasionally trying to pull the rug out from under the audience. But I find fishing incredibly tedious, and I really don't want to be stuck on a riverbank with Paul Whitehouse for an entire day in the cold on some bleak Scottish river. I'm happy to leave him and Bob to
do that. How do you relax, though, Charlie? I mean, if he's got his fishing, what kind of thing do you do? Have you got anything you do?
Badger baiting, mostly. But Vic Reeves and I tried to pitch that to the BBC. They didn't go for it.
You can't do anything these days, can you, Charlie?
No.
Let's talk about...
Political correctness gone mad. How do I relax? I relax the same as anyone else. I play a lot of computer games, games on my phone. I do a bit of painting, a bit of gardening. I paint toy soldiers.
Oh, cool.
Great. Oh, me and Andy are big gamers.
Oh, cool, he said.
Yeah, we are.
Swiftly moving. Aye, aye. Which ones? Oh, yeah, well, I can... Are those games behind you or DVDs?
They are games. I'm a big board gamer, role player. I paint me little miniatures as well.
Yeah.
In fact, absolutely.
Steve does all the art for... Which is the games, things that you do the art?
Crooked Dice is the game.
Crooked Dice.
Yeah. It's a Warhammer-style game, but... It's based around 70s and 80s film and TV characters, so it'll be like Del Boy versus Predator, that kind of thing. It's great.
It's great. It is amazing.
Well, and you have little painted figures.
Yeah.
I must check it out.
Great. It's like you're putting on a TV show against the other person, aren't you? So it might be sci-fi or a low budget TV show. It's fantastic.
Which TV show tends to be the all-time champion?
Well, they do their own mashups, their own kind of universe. I'm currently working on a 1980s expansion for this game, and two of the scenarios, one's called Neutron Nelson and the Rocket Revolution, and the idea is, what if Prince, on his bike from the 1999 poster, his bike was a kind of Knight Rider thing that talked to him, and he's fighting the Kraftwerk armies of Gary Newman, this kind of synth lord, which is amazing. And the other one is, it's the Odd Jobbers. What if Ghostbusters was a TV show made by the BBC in the 80s with the cast of Alvida Zane Pett, kind of these low rent, no money, get off the dole, so we're going to go and bust some ghosts. It's fantastic.
This podcast has taken a strange turn.
Hasn't it taken a turn? Well, let's get on track then, Charlie. As you well know, we invite a guest on each week, and they bring with them three things that have scarred them for life, hence the name. What would you be putting forward then, Charlie, as your first scar?
Well, it's a tricky one. I don't really have any deep scars because, as we touched on earlier, I've always been drawn towards the macabre and horror and the weirder corners of experience, but I think what Scarred for Life kind of touches on is like when you're ambushed. It's like if you're watching a horror film, you expect there to be some scary bits and some gore, but if you're just casually watching TV and then suddenly some strange children's show comes on with terrifying puppets, it can be upsetting. So I have lots of kind of shallow scars. So trying to find deep ones is tricky, but thinking about this, I remembered very much watching the film She for the first time.
She.
Do you know She?
I don't know She. Give us a bit of a précis of She then, Charlie.
Maybe you're all too young. It's a Hammer film based on a Rider Haggard novel. Rider Haggard, who wrote King Solomon's Mines and all these adventures. And one of the books he wrote is called, I think the book is called She as well. She Who Must Be Obeyed. It's about... In the Hammer version, it's about a group of explorers who end up finding this lost civilization. In the book, I think it's in the Arctic or the Antarctic, but in the Hammer film, it's in the middle of the desert. It's this civilization ruled by Ursula Andress as she who must be obeyed, Aisha. And it's got Bernard Cribbins as the sort of lovable sidekick. It's got Peter Cushing as the, you know, the knowledgeable archaeologist. It's got Christopher Lee as the priest of Aisha, sort of scary, nasty priest. I mean, it is a huge influence on Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Oh,
it's very much that kind of world where you find this weird civilization based around sacrificing people to this sort of lava inside this cave. And it's, you know, it's got all those hammer ingredients. It's got sort of sexy, scantily clad women. It's got quite a lot of gore and scary scenes. But there's a bit in it. And anyone who watched it as a kid, because, back in the sort of 60s and 70s, there were loads of movies on the TV all the time. And this is one that was always one on. And you'd sort of watch it maybe on a sort of Saturday afternoon. And, you know, it's a fun adventure. And, you know, it was fun watching some people being thrown to their death. But the whole idea of it is that she is immortal. There's this blue flame. And she stepped into it thousands and thousands of years ago. And she is the immortal goddess almost, who's ruling this civilization. I don't want to spoil it for you now because you've not seen it, but I'm going to have to give you the big spoiler
at
the end of
the
film.
Go on, do it.
And she falls in love with this young guy whose adventure, who is the spitting image of Alexander the Great, who she knew. And the reason they find out about all this is there are these coins that they find, the ancient coins, and it really looks like him, the picture on the coins. And he falls in love with her and she falls in love with him. But she says, I can't bear, you know, I will stay young and beautiful forever, but you will turn into an old man and die like all my other lovers. Unless you take the risk of stepping into the blue flame.
Ooh.
And so the climax of the film is they step into the blue flame together. And he's kind of invigorated and made immortal. And then she sort of looks at her hands, which are going all wrinkly, and her face starts to wrinkle.
Oh, no.
And she suddenly ages and turns to dust, and, you know, her skin falls off her face. She turns into a skeleton and collapses, and very much like the end scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
But, you know, as a 10-year-old watching this, it's suddenly, oh, my God. And you know, you would look at it today, the special effects wouldn't knock your socks off. But at the time, it was a classic Hammer thing. And I guess they'd done it in lots of their Dracula films. But it was a real kick in the guts because it was like, oh, yes, they're going to be in love forever. And suddenly she becomes this old woman and she's kind of clawing at him going, no, what's happening to me? And yeah, it turns into a skeleton, it turns into dust and dies. And he steps out of the flame and he's now immortal.
What happened, Holly? For God's sake, what happened?
There can only be one answer. A second time into the flame, fire takes away what it had given.
And me? What about me, Holly? I loved her. And now to live forever without her. No.
So, yeah, it's quite an unexpected ending. And as I say, as a child watching it for the first time, it completely ambushed you. And, you know, things like that, anything to do with, I mean, the thing about horror is it taps into all our basic fears of aging and disease and dying and all these things. And so it was very upsetting as a child. And I have tweeted about it, I think, over the years. And yeah, anyone who was my age who saw it then was similarly distressed.
I've got to ask, because I've been a horror obsessive since literally before I can remember. What are your tastes in horror then, Charlie? I know you've written young adult zombie novels, so you're obviously a bit of a zombie enthusiast as well, but where do your zombie horror
taste
lie?
Well, I mean, all the obvious ones. I mean, you know, as a kid, it was Hammer films. And it's really interesting because those were X films, and X films were always, you know, ooh, that's really adult. And now some of those early Hammer films are like PG certificate.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. But, you know, growing up, that was the only access to horror, really. You know, we didn't have DVDs or the internet or any of that stuff. You would have to watch it on TV, and it would be late at night, and you weren't supposed to be watching it, so you'd have to wait till your mum and dad had gone to bed and sneak down and watch
the double
it on
bills.
The TV sort of with the sound turned down, you know, keeping close to the screen so you could hear it. And they're weird, those Hammer films.
Yeah, I used to watch those double bills too, but my mum and dad let me. When we got our first colour TV, I got given the old black and white TV. I was allowed to take it upstairs.
Ah, right.
And I would watch those horror double bills. And the first one would be some ropey old 30s thing with Lionel Atwill in.
Yeah.
And then the second one would be like a Hammer one. And getting back to the thing about Ursula Andress, the thing that used to creep me out was every time Dracula died and his hands would go all papery and then the skin would kind of go back to the bones. It was, it was horrible.
Well, that's exactly what happened to Ursula Andress. you must check it out, although I have ruined the entire film for you. But yes, but I mean, those Hammer films, and I tweeted about this the other day because someone was doing some kind of Hammer tweets about the weird world that those Hammer films took place in.
Hmm.
This sort of, because in the books, you know, in Dracula, Jonathan Harker goes over from England, meets him, and then comes back to England, and Dracula follows him back across the sea, and they end up in Whitby and then London. But in the books, it all takes place in this weird sort of middle European place where everyone speaks English. And there's always a Burgermeister. And everyone kind of lives there. And, you know, because they didn't have the money to splash out. So it's, you know, you've got one village set, and some interiors and a castle set. But you just kind of took it for granted as a kid. And those films are not really that scary, but because they're late at night and you know, they had a good use of gore, which is why you missed out watching it black and white, because it was the bright red blood was... That's how Hammer brought it back. You know, we'd had that great Universal cycle of black and white films in the 30s. And then it had gone away. But when colour came in, Hammer said, what if we did Dracula in colour? And the blood was squirting everywhere and it was bright red. And that's one of the big reasons why those films were such a success, I think.
What was your access to scary stuff like then, Charlie, when you were a kid?
You'd sneak into the cinema, obviously, before you were 18. It was watching whatever you could on TV, and it was. I used to love the old sort of the likes of Lionel Atwill in the old black and white ones. I mean, some of those films are just amazing, like The Black Cat. It's a fantastic film. The sort of gateway with books, the gateway books to sort of for a lot of teenagers, particularly boys, to get you from reading kids' books to reading adult books, because there was no young adult fiction or teenage fiction then. It was, you know, Roald Dahl and then Agatha Christie. But horror was a big thing.
Hmm.
So the Hammer books of horror, not the Hammer, the Pan books of horror.
Yeah.
Were absolutely vital. I've got nearly a whole shelf of them here.
Wow.
And, you know, they were a mix of old horror stories, new, very gory horror stories, quite a lot of sex in them, which was always good fun as a young teenager. So that was a good thing. And then, you know, when I was old enough, I would go and see any horror film I could. And the 70s was a golden age for horror before it went sort of mainstream and above the board, probably after Jaws. You know, there was those sort of scuzzy, weird 70s films with no recognizable actors in, and so you couldn't tell what was going to happen at all. You know, these days, you know from the start who's going to make it through and who's going to die and the arc of the film. But then, you know, you would think this film has been made by a group of psychopaths and you could never predict where they were going to go. And I loved all that. And when I went to university, me and a friend started doing sort of all-night horror film shows. We would basically track down all the horror films that you just couldn't see in England, but you'd read about them in Fangoria magazine.
Oh, yeah.
And you could, I've still got a collection of all the early Fangorias. And you could just send off for the 16mm prints and project them in the schools, in the university library where I was in Norwich. Which was the first time I saw Night of the Living Dead, because you just couldn't see it in England. That would have been 1977.
Wow.
And you'd seen it and heard about it, but no way see it. And the audience was the same. And we put it on. There'd been a couple of films before. The audience was quite pissed. It was like 2 a.m. And it starts. And they're sort of giggling a bit at the beginning. It's a bit cheesy and corny, the first couple of scenes. But by about half an hour in, there's an absolute silence. People quite traumatised, because never having seen a flesh-eating zombie cannibal Holocaust movie before, nobody knew what to expect. And there's some great stuff in that film still.
So did you have to send back the, forgive my ignorance, when you got the actual
print? Yeah, you
don't
keep them.
Is it where you just rent it? Is that what it is? How does it work?
Yes, it's a rental. It's like a cinema.
Really?
You know, and because it was at the university, you didn't have to worry about certification, because a lot of these films didn't have certificates, because, you know, they'd never been shown in the UK. And a lot of them were the sort of films that ended up being called, you know, video nasties, all that crap in the 80s. But yeah, you rented them the same as any cinema could.
I hope you rewound it when you took it back, Charlie, like people didn't used to do it.
We were very professional. I mean, I didn't personally do it. The projectionist did.
Steve.
Well, that was the thing. That was the thing growing up as a horror fan in the 70s and especially the 80s. I was a teenager right in the middle of the whole, as you say, the video nasty nonsense, when they were just kind of scooping up random films. Like the Big Red one, the war film.
Did that become a video
nasty? It was briefly a video nasty because they assumed from the title it must be obscene. But
one of the guys did get one of his balls shot off.
That's true.
That'll do it.
And who plays Lee Marvin? Who's the sort of big tough old soldier?
Oh, because I remember, I think.
But he basically picks it up off the floor. This guy's clutching his crotch. And he goes, and he chucks it away, and he says, "That's why they give you two of them."
But I remember it was that kind of underground illicit thrill of trying to hunt down films that weren't allowed in this country. I used to know a guy when I was like from the age of 16, who everyone just knew in Liverpool as Pete Wigwam. No one knew why he was called Pete Wigwam. He was just a guy who knew everyone. He would get you. He would say, you'd kind of say, Blake 7 hadn't been released on VHS yet, and you'd be talking to him in the local comic shop in Liverpool about Blake 7, and he'd go, "Oh, I'll get that for you next week, Steve." And he would come out with the whole series the next week on like 20th generation VHS that was like watching it through a snowstorm. But he was like literally just getting me Last House on the Left and Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And it was that kind of
those films.
Yeah, it was that thing of, I can't quite believe I'm watching this film that you can now watch in HD on Amazon Prime.
Yeah. Well, that was the big, you know, the big change that came in at the beginning of the 80s was the whole video thing. And when it started, again, it wasn't like the cinema. You didn't have to be, you didn't have to get a certificate.
Yeah.
So anything was put out. And then the government starts, "Oh, young people are watching this. We need to control it." And it all went nuts. But of course, some fairly crap films suddenly became, you know, gold dust because they'd been put on the banned list.
Yeah, I watched some shite, some real shite. It was some awful films.
Well, that's important to do that as a horror fan.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. There's your first scar, Charlie. Let's go for scar number two then, please.
Well, I'm going to go with a book for number two. I had a choice of two books. One is a Victorian morality tale, and the other is a book which you must know, Struwwelpeter, Shock-Headed Peter.
Oh,
you're not
going
to tell me you don't know Struwwelpeter.
Yeah, terrifying.
I thought you guys were experts.
No, that comes
showing
up again.
Ourselves up.
That comes up again and again on Twitter. The big, horrifying.
I mean, it was a book that I first came across at school when I must have been about eight. It was a weird, dysfunctional little prep school in Sussex. Don't look for it. It isn't there anymore. called Font Hill. And, you know, it had a library of books, half of which were old Victorian books. And they had a copy of Struwwelpeter, which was written by this German guy in the late 19th century, I think. And he published it as a funny little book for children with funny little moral tales. And it is the most horrifying and upsetting and scary book, which has given so much to horror since. A lot of it goes back to Struwwelpeter.
I'm just looking at the pictures now. It's absolutely horrific. It's horrific.
It is. And that picture on the front, which
with
is Shock-Headed Peter, Struwwelpeter, he won't brush his hair, so he's got this huge mat of tangled hair, and he won't cut his fingernails, so he's got these long, horrible long fingernails. And that was considered a fun and funny little book.
What a study of it.
And, you know, there's a story in there of this child who won't stop sucking his thumbs. And he gets chased by the tailor, which is this guy with this huge, great pair of shears.
Jesus.
And he cuts his thumbs off.
Jesus.
That's a lot of fun. And there is something about the illustrations, which in themselves are very disturbing. It's the, you know, it's the these original 19th century illustrations. There's, you know, it's indefinable sometimes, isn't it? Why an image or a style or an illustration can get under your skin in that way. I mean, it's funny, my kids, and I'm probably a lot of kids really couldn't read Alice in Wonderland. They found the illustrations in that just too dark and weird. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's the drawing style, isn't it? It's kind of almost tarot card-esque.
Yeah, and there's something about the characters in Alice in Wonderland, but particularly with Strawpetter, with these children, these horrific things happen to these children. You know, they're being thrown into wells, and as I say, having their thumbs cut off and whatever. And and that's considered a fun. And the guy wrote it because he couldn't find any funny books for his own kids. So
bloody hell.
Well, I think things were different then. Certainly, there's no trigger warnings in it. Which brings, you know, and the other book that I was almost chose is this. It's from 1875. It's a book called Froggy's Little Brother. Which was written by a woman who under the pen name of Brenda, and she wrote a lot of these stories, socially campaigning stories about the poor, about street kids and orphans and the terrible time they had. And this book, I was ill one time. Well, I must have been about 10, and my mum went out, and I think she found a book in a secondhand bookshop or something. She came back and said, "Oh, you know, there's a nice little children's book for you. You might like it." Froggy and his little brother Benny, they're both small children, and their parents die. It's all set in the sort of East End of London, and so Froggy has to try and bring up his little brother and look after him and try and work to get money to get food to feed him, and of course, you know, it being a Victorian morality thing, Benny dies, and it is the most upsetting book, and I remember just crying for, you know, for days when I read it, and for years I couldn't even look at the book without crying again. And it's only recently I've been able to sort of look at it, and still, I won't go back and reread it. But I looked it up before doing this, and there was on Amazon, there was a sort of new edition, and it was saying, a marvellous book for children. They all love it, and it's great to read as a bedtime story. But no.
Don't do it.
You know, when every children's book now is kind of, it's all about, you know, children's mental health and looking after them, but honestly, it is the most upsetting book. And you know, you realise that things were different back then.
Sometimes reading books at school used to freak you out. I remember the Ghost of Thomas Kemp. Do you remember that book? You guys ever had to read that? It was about a poltergeist. He was a poltergeist.
Right. Yes. That rings a bell.
And those kind of things, like you say, maybe a bit of the illustrations. If you Google Froggy's Little Brother, what I love about this podcast, by the way. Schools of people normally go and check stuff out that you guys have talked about, and then we'll come back to us in the week. So if you've had a look at it, let us know what you think, particularly the fellow with the hair from earlier on, the really long figure.
Oh, well, Strawpetter. I mean, if you haven't read Strawpetter, you've got to get it. I mean, you know, there's a lot of very good, modern facsimile publications of it. And I bought one, and my kids said, don't have it in the house. I had to hide it.
Wow.
They looked at it once and said, no. Get rid of it.
Get rid of the damn thing. Dave?
Yeah, I buy old books, not because they're scary themselves, because I find there's something very upsetting in a way about really old books, especially if they've got like somebody's put an inscription in one, and it just says something like, I find that quite sad. The one I quite like, actually, I bought this book from, I think it was 1910, it was a children's magazine from 1910, it was dedicated to the sons of the empire upon which the sun will never set.
Oh my word.
And I thought, four or five years later, they're going over the top, aren't they? So there's something about old books. It's just a bit creepy.
I find the same with old photographs. I can't look at them without thinking, everybody in this picture is dead.
Yeah.
You know, look at those children singing and dancing and having a lovely time. They're dead. their pet dog is dead, and the past is gone, and so I do find it quite hard.
I get that feeling from the titles of Bagpuss. Bagpuss is like
Bagpuss is horrendous, isn't it?
Yep. Everybody involved in the making of that is dead.
They're all dead.
The repeats from Everybody's Top dead. Of the Pops from the 70s that BBC 4 were showing.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's my childhood, but it hit me about 20 episodes in. I was watching kind of Pan's People, whoever it was, and I kind of went,
"Yeah,
oh, hang on, they're all in the 70s and 80s. And I kind of just had this huge...
Or they're dead.
Oh, they're dead. This huge mortality rush just attacked me.
Or the hosts are locked up. That's the other one you can play the Top of the Pops as well.
Yeah, but they don't... They have to all be heavily re-edited now.
They do.
Certain shows they could show. I mean, I contributed to a book on Withnail and I, which was published recently. And for publication day, they did a special screening at the Prince Charles Cinema in London with Bruce Robinson. And they asked me if I would interview him before the film, which was great fun. I mean, he's a really interesting and very funny guy. And then we sat down together to watch the film, and the opening credits came up, and there's the sort of, I don't know, there's about 10 the sort of main names that come up first involved in making the film. And he turned to me and said, 7 of them are dead.
Charlie, what do you remember the first thing that scared you ever, like your first ever, like when you were the littlest kids?
Well, no, I mean, you know, if I did, I would have written it down. No, there was nothing.
No incident, or you didn't have any ghosts in your life or anything like that? Nothing going on? No supernatural?
No, I didn't have any of that. I've never seen ghosts or monsters. I mean, obviously, you know. I mean, I do remember quite vividly being a child when you'd get a fever and you'd be drenched in sweat and you'd go bonkers.
Yeah.
And you would start hallucinating.
Seeing shit.
Yeah. And I remember one time my bedroom was full of Portuguese sailors. I don't know how I knew they were Portuguese.
Wow.
But I knew they were sailors. And I remember another time I was terrified of something in my room with this kind of fever hallucination dream. And I wanted to go to my parents' room and they were at the end of the landing and there was a light hanging from the ceiling. And in my hallucination, I believed that there was a line drawn across this light bulb and that if I crossed it, I would die. So I was there for half the night in the corridor, terrified to cross this imaginary line drawn on the underside of the light bulb. And eventually I just crawled back to my bed. So, yeah, that's probably the really the scary things that I remember from my childhood.
That is fascinating, actually, because I've had similar stuff where, you know, when you're ill as a kid and you say wake up, if you're staying somewhere else with your family and you don't know, you wake up and you don't know where you are or how to get out of your own room, or that's that kind of sleep paralysis kind of scare thing as well.
And, and you can see that this is the birth of dreams and demons and all that stuff. It's we're cooking them up. Literally, if you're overheating, you're cooking them up in our fevered brains.
Charlie, let's get your third and final scar then, please.
Well, I was tossing up between various TV things. And obviously, and I didn't go for it in the end, was the sort of the old BBC ghost story for Christmas, which, you know, I remember actually watching them originally when they went back. But you kind of think, well, those are scary things and they're meant to be scary, so you wouldn't put them on a list. But there was a certain, and these shows, you know, those things like that, and also a series like Beasts, are still really odd and disturbing because of the way that they were shot.
Yeah.
You know, there was this old thing with a lot of drama, comedy, even things like Monty Python, is if they're indoors, it's all shot in a studio on video cameras. But as soon as anyone goes outside, it's suddenly shot on a film camera. And it looks and feels completely different because the video cameras at the time were not portable. And it gives a very strange atmosphere to things. But I think it's mainly I think it's the sound that really makes these things scary, because it wasn't all Dolby and it wasn't all everything recorded and then multi-track recording and playing in these bits. They tended to be quite quiet. But then they would use odd and disturbing sounds. Not in the sort of cheap way of suddenly is a loud banging sound, which you get in a lot of modern horror films, and a really loud sort of screeching noise. But there would be odd, unidentifiable sounds, and everything else would be silent. But then you'd get this weird sound, and particularly that gives it this such an atmosphere to those BBC ghost stories, which is very hard to recreate. You know, Omar Gatiss has been really trying to sort of bring it back and making some interesting stuff, but somehow it's hard to capture that really specific atmosphere that in the 70s that,
well, you
that,
know,
that,
there was
that filming
one...
had.
I was going to mention, I feel like I mention this all the time, but have you heard of Whistle and I'll Come to You, which is the M.R. James?
The Jonathan Miller one is one of the scariest things ever made. It's just absolutely brilliant. Because
it's got that kind of sleep paralysis fever thing that you were talking about in it as well, with the bed sheets.
Yes, and that great scene on the beach where there are these strange sounds which are like things slowed down. They sound a bit like a cow in distress. And it's not all banging and the music screeching. It's just these odd sounds and images and using the imagination to make it. No, I mean, that is a stupendous piece. But the one that really sticks in my mind was called, and I had to look it up.
Lost Hearts, was it?
Lost Hearts.
Yeah. Oh, phenomenal.
Yes. Which is about the sort of ghosts of the two dead children in the house.
Yeah, with the hurdy-gurdy.
And there's a very... Yes. Again, the use of the sound there. That one was colour though, which is interesting. But there's an image of them at the window with their kind of rib cages torn open and their hearts missing. Which,
yeah,
you know, again, as a small boy, that's quite upsetting. But I didn't want to go with them because those, again, you watch them expecting to be scared. You know what you're getting into.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, I think it's when you're ambushed that things really get to you. And actually, the one of the things that really got to me when I was a kid, and I would have been, I think, about 12, was The Six Wives of Henry VIII.
Which was
a classic BBC costume drama with Keith Michelle as the king. And they had two or three different writers writing each episode. Each one was about a different wife. And in the Anne Boleyn one, there's a lot of torture. Now, you don't see any of the torture. You see the sort of lead up to it, and you see people talking about it and people utterly traumatized by it and the aftermath. And one of the details of that was the idea of if you get a rope with two knots in it that you put around the head with the knots over the eyes and you slowly tighten it around the back of the head. And, you know, if you don't tell the torturer what they want to hear, they will keep going until your eyeballs explode, essentially.
No.
When we put that round your head and begin to twist, those little knots will push your eyes out, pop, like chestnuts in the fire.
No, you can't.
Admit your guilt, it will suffice. Admit the charges, Smeaton. Just say, I am guilty, and there will be no need to twist the rope.
I cannot.
As you wish.
And I, you know, I find the whole idea of torture very upsetting, that someone would casually, you know, and it's their job. They do it for a living.
Yeah.
They would calmly and casually do that to someone. And most torture scenes in films, I think, don't work because the torturers tend to be weird, cackling, sadistic types who are sort of shouting and being nasty. But the idea of just someone doing it very straightforward, matter-of-factly, this is my job, I'm going to do this, while the interrogator is asking questions. I find that really upsetting. It's like that scene in Brazil with Michael Palin as this lovely, mild-mannered torturer who is this crazy scene. Is it him or the woman that Jonathan Pryce goes to see? They've got headphones on and they're typing something up and they take the headphones on and you just hear a little sound of like, ah! And you see that typing up on the screen is like, oh, ow, ah, stop. But it's all done in a very sort of boring, BBC, sort of bureaucratic way.
Yeah.
And that was what got me about that torture thing. The simplicity of it and the nastiness of it, of you don't need a big nasty device, but a rope with a couple of knots in it.
Steve.
That's just jogged a memory for me as well, Charlie, about being ambushed when you least expect it. There's a scene in I, Claudius that horrified me as a kid. I was sometimes allowed up late to watch stuff, but I remember watching I, Claudius as a kid with my parents, not getting a lot of it because it's very complex, but I watched it again years later on DVD. Scene where it is basically there's a boy coughing his guts up in the background of the scene, and it's getting John Hurt's tit. He's basically, can you do something about that boy's cough, please? It's really annoying me. So this general, this soldier says, yes, sir, and goes off screen with the kid. The scene just carries on. It's like that's dealt with. The whole scene with Caligula carries on, blah, 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 blah. They reach a resolution. And at the end of the scene, the soldier comes back, says, I've dealt with his cough, sir, and holds up the boy's dripping head. And I was absolutely hot. I think I left the room because I've always been very squeamish on top of being a horror
fan. I vividly remember that. And as you say, it's the casualness of it and it's the sort of bureaucracy of it. Can you sort that out? Oh, certainly, sir.
I've just killed a child.
And that is so much more upsetting than if it was like, that child, and someone came screaming in and hacking away at them.
Dave.
Yeah, there's a bit in I, Claudius where a woman gets her head chopped off, but you don't see anything. You see the guy bring the sword, and then the camera suddenly pans to the side to give you the impression that the head's flying off. And I think that upset me as well, even though you don't see a single thing.
Yeah.
Sounds horrific, this I, Claudius.
Like. Oh, it's an amazing series. I must go back and watch it again, because, you know, I watched it religiously when it was first on. And, there's a lot of upsetting scenes, and you know, you realize the sort of brutality that can get built into the system.
So, I mean, this kind of ties in nicely with your podcast, Charlie, because obviously there's something kind of, there's an incredible cruelty about, not that era, just Henry VIII, but, you know, that kind of run of kings and people being locked in towers and flayed and all that. Tell us about your podcast. It's about the whole the Tudors, but elaborate.
It is a history of our monarchy. It's called Willy Willy Harry Stee, which is based on a rhyme I learned as a small boy at that same prep school where I first came across Struwwelpeter. And it's a way of this rhyme is a way of remembering the monarchs from William the First up to the present day. So it starts with Willie, William the First, Willie, Willie, Harry, Stee, Harry, Dick, John, Harry, 3, 1, 2, 3, Neds, Richard, 2, et cetera, up to Charles the Third. And during lockdown, I kind of relearned the rhyme properly. And then I thought, because I had time on my hands and I needed to sort of count sheep before going to bed, before going to sleep, I thought, I want to properly learn who all these people were.
Because it's confusing, isn't it? It's incredibly confusing.
Because you sort of know, we know William the Conqueror and King Harold, and we know Henry the Fifth. Henry VIII, Queen Elizabeth, some of the other ones. We don't really know how it fits together and how we get from one to the other. And I just found it such a fascinating story. And at night I would go through them in my head so that I would remember who they all were. Hmm. And I didn't usually make it through the Hanoverians, who are quite dull. And then I thought, actually, you know, this I would quite like to share this and learn more about it. So, like every other bugger on the planet, I thought I'll do a podcast, and I've been really enjoying it. So, essentially, in each episode, I talk for about half an hour about each monarch. I'd start with William the First and just do them in order. It's a narrative history. It's a story of the story of our nation, really, and go through them one by one. I talk for about half an hour. And then I have a proper historian on who I talk to for about half an hour, who can sort of it'd be a bit more detail about it.
I was going to say we were talking about board games and stuff earlier on. I'm a like Steve. I'm a board game geek, and there's a new game by called Plantagenet, which is about the Wars of the Roses. So I thought, right, I'm going to let me try and learn about the Wars of the Roses a little bit. And it's incredibly confusing.
So
have you guys covered that yet?
I've done the Wars of the Roses. So yes, if you really want to know about it, start with Henry the Sixth. Essentially, you could listen from Henry the Sixth through to Henry the Seventh.
Did you have a good history teacher at school, though? Because I think maybe sometimes...
Well, I mean, I had an old-fashioned... You know, I was at school in the 60s, so they were still teaching a narrative approach to history. At the prep school I was at, you didn't have classes. You would go to different rooms. So that one room was a history room, one room was geography, and you'd go to the history room. And there was a frieze around the walls that some child... children had done many years ago, which basically did start with the Romans. And there were pictures and dates and battles and kings and queens all around the walls leading up to, well, Elizabeth II, as it was then. And yeah, you would start on your first day, you'd start at one end of this and then you'd work your way around. And you could see it there as a thing, as a story.
Yeah.
But modern history teaching is you learn a lot about the Tudors, the Egyptians, the Romans. As you get older, you do the American Civil Rights Movement, the First World War. But you won't necessarily know in what order these things took place.
Yeah.
And how you got from one to the other. So mine is a very old-fashioned concept. It's going back to the idea of narrative. It's telling a story. And it's a really interesting story, you know, because there's this idea, and I think it got embedded in our heads because Elizabeth ruled for so long and it was such a placid, uncontroversial reign. There was this idea that that's what monarchs were.
Yeah.
All very calm, and one thing led to another, and it was this unbroken line back to William the First. But it's not like that. It's a mad story, and it's not an unbroken line. It zigzags all over the place, and people are killing each other and starving the previous monarch to death.
Yes, yeah, horrendous.
And you know, murdering them in different ways and usurping the throne. It's an amazing story, and it's a fascinating story, and I've really enjoyed finding out more about it. But you know, as you say, that the brutality that, and the casual brutality, you know, with a hanging, that the whole town would turn out, and you know, if you were treasonous back in the Middle Ages, it would be hanging. You'd be hung, drawn and quartered, which means you would be hung until you were half dead, then you'd be cut down while you were still alive, and then it would cut your stomach open and pull your entrails out in front of you, show them to you, chuck them in the fire, and then chop you into four pieces.
That'd do the trick, wouldn't it?
And occasionally they would also cut off your genitals and burn them in front of you.
Blimey.
And everyone would turn up to watch that.
Belt and braces, that is.
I remember, you know, I can't imagine what that was like.
There was one, I remember reading about one monarch in my attempt to try and get my head around the Wars of the Roses. Didn't they used to get like drowned in like some really posh wine?
This was the Duke of Clarence, who was Richard III's older brother and the younger brother of Edward IV. And he was a real flaky character. And he was constantly plotting against Edward to try and take the throne. And eventually Edward got fed up with him and locked him up in the tower, and he was killed there. And Edward said he drowned in a butt of Malmsey wine.
Right.
But to spoil the story, they think that Edward was just making a joke because George, Duke of Clarence, was a notorious pisshead.
Right.
and he said it as a joke. But there are old films. There's a great film. I think it's something about, I think it might even be called The Tower of London, with Vincent Price playing, I'm not sure what character he plays, but in that they basically get the Duke of Clarence shoving headfirst into a barrel of wine until his feet stop kicking. But yeah, I mean, it was an extraordinary time, and it's the same when you think about the sort of the Colosseum and those shows that the Romans put on, that people would happily turn up as a family to watch people being torn apart.
Steve.
It's a weird thing, you know, because I've always, as someone who's very squeamish when it comes to gore on screen or real stuff, I've always thought about that mentality myself. The idea of a society that would turn up almost with popcorn to watch someone get hung or their entrails ripped out. But I've never forgotten a letter to Starburst magazine in 1979. Like, at the time, Alien was the film I wanted to see more than anything else.
Yeah,
and obviously, I was 9 years old. It was never going to happen. But I remember an absolutely outraged letter to Starburst talking about the chestburster scene. And this guy was basically going, this is it, the fall of society. It's bread and circuses all over again. If this is what they're letting us watch on screen, and I'm kind of thinking, this must be the goriest, most extreme thing ever. But I love the idea that this guy went to pictures to see Alien and thought, right, that's it. That civilization's collapsing like it did in Roman times.
End of days.
Insane. Yeah. Insane.
He obviously hasn't watched the Serbian film.
Oh, God.
What is a Serbian film, guys? You're going to have to...
Come on. Oh. What kind of a website is this?
Don't Google it. No, listeners, don't Google it.
I won't tell you.
Don't Google
it. Just watch it for yourself.
Oh.
I can't just ask for the Serbian film. Who do I speak to?
That's what it's called.
It's called the Serbian film.
Serbian film or the Serbian movie?
It's freely available. It's a proper film. But reading the synopsis on Wikipedia made me turn white. I kind of thought, oof.
I'll have a look tonight. Thanks, lads. Cheers for that. Dave?
I've got a completely different question about brutality, specifically James Bond.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I read the James Bond books when I was a teenager, so I'm going by my memories of Sean Connery most of all.
Right.
James Bond, as far as I remember, is a very brutal individual. I'm thinking particularly there's a scene in Goldfinger at the start where he's kissing a woman, sees a reflection of a guy creeping up on him from behind, turns the woman round so she takes the blow, electrocutes the guy, and then leaves the woman lying on the floor with like the smoke rising from this guy's burned corpse. And it just struck me as how strange it is that that's then a young adult character. I mean, did you...
It's a weird one. I mean, that sounds more like the film than the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting that in this country, James Bond, I mean, I think it's possibly changed a bit with the Daniel Craig films, is seen as sort of family entertainment. Hmm. And the first film that I actively remember going to see in the cinema is Thunderball. And I would have been about six, I think. I mean, I must have seen other films before that, but that's the one that I actually remember going to see. And I remember being really excited and thinking this was the most amazing thing ever, and thinking that James Bond was just incredible, but also thinking he's not like the other sort of heroes I've seen on the TV. He's a bit nasty. You know, and there's a scene in the Thunderball film where he's dancing with the girl and the woman in the nightclub, and he doesn't exactly use her as a human shield, but it's almost that basically she gets shot. And he basically just sits her down at someone else's table. And he says something like, oh, she's dead on her feet. Or it might even be just, oh, she's dead. You know, as in colour, like dead tired. And walks out and you think, and I remember thinking as a kid, that's quite extreme. And there's a bit on the beach, you know, he's snogging the woman. And the villain turns up and he kind of pins him to a tree with a harpoon. Says something. Says, "Oh, he got the point," and it goes back to snogging the woman. and there's a scene in that. I mean, going back to torture, there's a scene where Largo tortures the woman by stubbing out a cigar on her and then rubbing ice on it so he can do it again. Oof. And you know, this was a family thing that parents were taking their kids to, and. It was a lot of fun. And then, you know, obviously in the 70s, when they started being shown on TV regularly, you'd watch them at Christmas and bank holidays and special occasions. I mean, certainly by the time you got to the 70s with Roger Moore, they were quite sort of lighthearted, just general family entertainment. But yeah, in this country, we've seen them as light entertainment. And it's something that fathers can share with their sons particularly. And it's interesting, when I did the Young Bond books, which were for... They weren't young adult. They were kind of just pre that, the sort of, I suppose, 10 to 14 year olds. They were very popular in the UK. They struggled a bit in the US, because over there, James Bond wasn't really seen as something for kids. It was seen as an adult grown up thing. So that was quite interesting. But yeah, you know, what one should watch with one's children has changed a lot over the years.
So, Charlie, you're an incredibly busy man. You've got lots of stuff going on. Is there anything, obviously, with the podcast, any other new projects that you've got on the horizon?
Well, I mean, if you're into it, we talked about James Bond. I finally wrote an adult James Bond book, which was out earlier this year, which is in the shops, on His Majesty's Secret Service, which was written for the coronation. I've also got my recent adult thriller, Whatever Gets You Through the Night, which is an excellent book. And I'm working on a new kids book at the moment, which will be out sometime next year. But the main thing I'm doing at the moment is a podcast, which I'm really, really enjoying. And actually, just finally, one more nasty anecdote from history.
yeah, please do.
Simon de Montfort, or Simon de Montfort, is seen as the sort of the father of Parliament. He was, this was during Henry III's reign, son of King John. He created essentially the House of Commons. Commoners had a representation in Parliament, and he led a parliamentary army, very much like Oliver Cromwell, to try and get rid of Henry III and have the country ruled by the aristocracy, but by the people. Unfortunately, depending on what side you're on, he lost and was defeated and killed. And he was then executed. And the sort of guy in charge of organizing all that was one. There's been various Roger Mortimers in history. This was one of the Roger Mortimers. And as a Valentine's gift to his wife, he sent Simon de Montfort's head in a box to her, with his testicles draped over his nose.
Oh,
so, my words. You know, if you're thinking of an unusual gift for your wife for Christmas.
And all because the lady loves it, it's a bit.
You know,
exactly.
You know, that was one step further than seven. Wow. People in real life have done much more horrible things than they've cooked up in films.
I bet. Well, tell us the name of the podcast one more time, Charlie, because it's fantastic.
Willy Willy Harry Stee, Charlie Higson's History of the Monarchy.
Superb. Well, let's wrap it up then. In your three scars, we have at number one the movie She from Hammer Horrors. Mm-hmm. Number two, Straw Petter with its hair and its long fingernails, etc., and Froggy's little brother.
Yeah, but let's go with Shockheaded Peter.
Shockheaded Peter, and then number three, The Six Wives of Henry VIII, with a footnote for me to check out the Serbian film that you guys were talking about. it's been an absolute honour to have you on the podcast. Charlie Higson, thank you so much for talking to Scarred for Life.
It's been great fun talking to you guys. And, you know, I do love your tweets, so keep it
thank
up.
Thank you very much. Do you know what? I feel I can't let you go without asking about you writing a fighting fantasy book, because that is incredible. That must have been such a thrill. That's amazing.
Well, it was. I mean, to tell you the truth, I was slightly too old to be the target audience when they came out, because I was in my 20s. But I'd always loved fantasy and gaming and playing games. And I saw these books, and I suddenly saw that they were everywhere. Kids were just devouring them. And I thought, there's something going on here. And I bought a couple and played through them. And I could instantly see why they were so popular. There was such an amazing thing, so well done, so beautifully done. And years later, I got to know Ian Livingstone, who was one of the creators, who is now kind of the big man in the British gaming and computer industry. Amazing guy. And he said, you know, if we ever do any more, do you fancy having a go? And I said, yeah, of course. And so they did a sort of relaunch with a different publisher, and I got to write one called The Gates of Death.
Wow.
Set in the world that Ian and Steve Jackson had created. And it was huge fun, but a complete mindfuck.
Well, how do you write it? Do you have to like have loads of bits of paper on the wall with bits of string and stuff like that? Like in terms of
well, I thought I could just sort of launch in and do it. I thought, I'm a clever bloke. I mean, Ian Livingstone showed me his diagrams that he did for his ones, and they are just incomprehensible, just lines going everywhere. But he has that sort of certain mind to make that work. And I thought, well, I'll just work it out. I kind of know how it works. I found it really interesting, the idea of creating a branching storyline, because you have to make it that every time you come to a choice, it's a significant choice for the reader. It's not just things that are slightly different. Which is what I always hated about Sliding Doors. The two stories are virtually the same. Anyway, that's a diversion. And so to come up with this idea of this branching storyline, to really give the reader the feel that they are in charge of this story. I mean, it's an illusion. You have to kind of steer them. You can't be completely open-ended. And then, you see, the thing that I got stuck on is these books were like the sort of template for so many computer games at the same came since, all the RPG games and whatever.
Yeah.
But the difference is, if in a computer game, if you get trapped in a cottage, and the only way out is to twat a troll and kill it and go. But you realize, oh, I forgot. I realize now that there was a really important thing hidden in a chest there. I've got to go back for it. And you go back. If you go back in, the troll is still dead, and you can go to the chest and open it and get what you're looking for. And I got stuck in the book of this thing. Well, in a book, because you're rigidly following the numbers through the book, if you go back there, how do you make it that the troll is dead?
So there's no way back, and
I got stuck in this bloody cottage in the woods for days and days trying to work out how to do it without adding in loads and loads of extra bits and pieces and numbers and pages, and I eventually worked out where I'd gone wrong and how to fix it, but it was a really good way to think in a different way about how to tell a story and how to write a book. This idea of constantly putting in choices.
Yeah, no, I think it's that it was the art in mixed in with obviously what was written as well. My dad used to sit there and read it to me and my brother when we were kids. So he would read it out and then we'd make the choice and roll the dice and everything. Like, it definitely, absolutely, that put me on the path towards being into fantasy and gaming.
Yeah.
I think it had a huge effect on you know, an entire generation. Well, listen, we will leave you and love you and leave you, as my nan says when she's on the phone. Charlie Higson, thank you so much. Great to speak to you.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
That's it for another week. A huge thank you again to Charlie Higson. Go and check out some of the creepy stuff we've talked about in this episode. I certainly will be with the Serbian movie, etc. We'll be back next week with another special guest sharing their deepest, darkest fears. You can, as ever, get in touch. You can tweet us at ScarredForLife2 on Twitter, Insta, ScarredForLifeBook, Facebook page as well. Come and say hello. A thriving community of people sharing stuff that scared the bejesus out of them there as well. And you've been listening to Scarred for Life, a Stellar Content production edited by Stephen Brotherston. And the title music is Scarred for Life by Soulless Party. Thank you for joining us. And remember, do have nightmares. We'll see you next week.